Hey there, and welcome to the Two Mom Life podcast, a show for moms like us, balancing it all and ready to live an inspired and full life. Everybody, welcome. I'm your host, Jody Fried, mom of four, Jewish community professional, and mother's empowerment coach. Motherhood is a journey, and on this podcast, inspired by Jewish thought, you will learn from other moms, receive practical advice, and loads of inspiration. Motherhood is messy and certainly not perfect. So here is to mom life, to finding your way, to finding perfect moments. Here is to you.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the To Mom Life podcast. Chana, it is so wonderful to be back here with you. I think the last time we were talking together was, I don't know, maybe 2 years ago or three.
Yeah, it was like at the beginning of COVID. It was intense back then.
And, you know, I think what strikes me always about you is like, one, just you're so grounded. You have, I think it's just your way that like, you just have this sense of calm, you know, about you. And it always feels like you have 2 feet kind of, you know, stuck to the ground, which I think is an amazing quality, like, especially in these times. And, you know, I, of course, follow your work, and it just seems like you've been up to so, so much recently. And our goals and missions are incredibly aligned, you know, so just like helping women, helping Jewish women, helping the world, doing our little part. And it's an honor to have you back. So thanks for joining me.
Such a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
So tell our listeners a little bit about you and about your journey and what you do, how you got there.
So I've been actually spending a big chunk of the past year really clarifying, okay, what's my story? Like, how do I explain to people how it is I got to be where I am right now? And really the, you know, the most formative moment of my life happens when I was 5 years old. I'd been five for all of a month. And on my fifth birthday, my mom told me, I know this is going to sound silly, but it's actually a big deal. And for you moms out there, you're going to know how big of a deal this is. I was very attached to my thumb and I was very attached to my blankie. And my mom said, you're now 5 years old, no more thumb and no more blankie. And I wasn't really ready to let them go, but I wanted to be the good girl. And so I did let them go, which might not have been so bad, except a month later, I was in the middle of a guitar lesson. My sisters and I were all learning guitar from this teacher. And there was a knock at our front door. This, by the way, is in Bogota, Colombia. I might have a really good American accent, but I'm originally from Bogota. And there was a knock on the door and the housekeeper innocently opened the door and five armed men barged into the house.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
And they had my mother at gunpoint for 2 hours and were trying to figure out how they could like embezzle money from her and all of this stuff. And we were not wealthy people by any means. And she convinced them somehow, miraculously, that they didn't need to kidnap us, which was what they were threatening, because she would figure out how to get money for them the next day. And my mom can be pretty charming. Thank God. This is like the miraculous moment. Because when I was a kid, we knew people who got kidnapped and oftentimes they didn't come back. It wasn't a joke. This was a real thing in Colombia. Those of you who know about, you know, life in Colombia or in Mexico today, like it's like a real thing.
I have complete chills. And like, were they targeting your family or was it
they
just
were
random?
Targeting our family. They knew everything about us. So my mother had recently fired her secretary for, I don't know why, but whatever, things weren't working out. And a few months later, it was in the newspaper that that secretary had been murdered. So my mom put two and two together because she was trying to figure out these guys knew everything about us. They knew the detailed map of our house. They knew exactly where my mom kept her safe. And so once they follow you and they know everything about you, you basically have to flee the country because that's it. You have no recourse. You have nowhere to go. And my mom put my sisters and me in a non-Jewish family that my parents knew. They were trying to figure out who's like the least connected to us, the people they could trust. So they put us in that house and we were there for like a day or two. Within 48 hours, we fled the country, moved to Miami. And my father still had a factory in Colombia. So he'd go back to take care of his factory. And every time he went to Colombia, he lived this clandestine kind of life. He stayed in a different place, took a different taxi at a different time of day, ate in a different restaurant at a different time of day. Like every single day, he made sure that it was different so nobody could follow him and track him down.
Oh my God. It's crazy. Like from one of these TV shows that I watch sometimes yeah. because my husband really likes them. It's real and it's so scary. So scary. Okay. So take us back to the thumb and the blankie and this crazy situation.
So, right. So I have Oof. No like inner resources, no nothing. I've got totally traumatized parents. My dad feels totally demasculated by this thing. My mom is freaking out every time anything. We moved to the States. They're trying to figure out how they're going to get things together financially. And therapy was not really in the conversation in Colombia in the 1980s. Like it was sort of in the conversation in America in the 1980s, but in Colombia for sure not. So none of us got therapy. None of us got help. All of my mom's friends kept saying, oh, you're so strong. You'll be fine. Kids, they get over this very quickly. And like children typically do, I created a whole story about my understanding of what had happened. And one of the things that I've really come to understand that I communicate to my clients and students globally all the time is that just like as children, we're really bad at cooking, at tying shoes, at karate, at writing, at art. Like we suck at everything, right? And we totally expect children to be really poor doers of every single thing you can imagine.
Yes.
And we get that, right? And we're like, oh yeah, I'm bad at drawing, but that's okay. Cause over time I'll get better and better. And then I can write my name and people can actually read it. No problem. Right. The challenge is that the stories we create as children, we treat them as though they fell out of the sky, as though it's like Torah from Sinai straight into our hands. And we have to bow down to these stories. And that's exactly what I did. I came to the conclusion the world is not a safe place, that I can't take care of myself. I kept having all of these nightmares. So I also came to the conclusion I can't trust my mind. Everywhere I went, I was scared of getting kidnapped or raped. And so like, I came to the conclusion that it was just my destiny to be kidnapped or raped, right? These are just stories that I made up in my head, but I believed them so deeply. And they created within me so much anxiety and eventually depression. And after years of pretty useless therapy, which is often what people say to me when they come to me as a coach, they're like, I've spent so much time in therapy going nowhere. I eventually found people and resources and tools that could help me turn things around to where now I feel like much more resilient and excited, and I feel safe in the world, and like I can take care of myself, and that I can trust my mind. It's like literally opposites of all of those stories I created as a kid. It was a pretty big deal.
That's a huge deal. And as you're talking, I'm finding parallels to my own life. You know, we came to the States when I was 10, and it wasn't quite as quick of a turnaround, but we were in South Africa, and there was also, you know, this feeling of insecurity and things being unsafe. And really, as I remember it, the straw that broke the camel's back, like we were out of the country 2 months after my father and my uncles were held up in front of our house at gunpoint. And we were all inside and the doors were like all wide open, which we never used to leave the doors wide open there. But like within 2 months, you know, we were gone because it was just, you know, but it's that fear. And I carried that with me as well. Even sometimes till now, but also like I've done a lot of work and got over and worked through a lot, but you know, there are those stories and that fear. And I remember so well until I mean, probably in college, like every night when I would go to bed, looking around the room and checking the windows and the corners of the room to like make sure that there were no shadows or people, or like, it's what you're saying is unbelievable and so relatable to me, I think, especially because of those parallels. But we all have these stories. And I think we have stories from childhood that, as you're saying, like we carry through as, you know, Taramisi and I. And we also make up stories, I think, when we get into adulthood too, you know, like the things that go wrong or the things that we feel insecure about kind of magnified and magnified and magnified. So how did you work through it? What was your process? Like you went through this useless therapy, and then how did you get to that point of being in the complete, you know, opposite spot right now?
So there were two pieces that were really, really big for me. One is I'm a person who lives with soul, like having a soul and being a soul and understanding that my soul is infinite and has been here before and will be here again. That kind of consciousness, I think, was deep within me and was waiting for someone to reflect that kind of consciousness back to me. So that's part of why therapy wasn't working, was that they were talking to what they felt was basically a machine. You know, like it's that mechanistic medical model where it's like, oh, you have an issue with your heart. So you're going to go to a heart doctor who's going to fix this machine called the heart and, you know, rewire things like a mechanic would when you bring them into an auto, your auto into the shop. So that just wasn't really resonating. It lacked a sense of big picture. It lacked a sense of God being in the world and that me being a being of God and seeking God. Already having people reflect back to me a much higher level of spiritual consciousness was huge. And the other piece that was huge was this thing that I was saying about the stories that we create and how we can rewrite our stories. So all of the work that I do revolves around that. I have a few children's books that I'm one day going to finish. You know, they're like, they're the books that tend to sit on the shelf and not get done, but they're really all about how stories shape our lives. And all of the, you know, adult books that my husband and I write are deeply embedded in that concept of story and using story to teach lessons or using, you know, in my books, Hold That Thought, like, yeah, here. So I have this book.
Is that your new book?
This is my older book. And this is my new book that just came out literally last week, Inner Voices. So, so there's Hold That Thought and there's Inner Voices and people can get this for free from my website. And this one is available on Amazon. And in both of these books, I teach people tools for how to look at the stories, the beliefs, the thoughts, whatever you want to call it, that they have about either a specific situation or themselves or life in general, and question those beliefs and shift into a different state of thinking. So the fact that my thoughts can be so deeply shaped by how I choose to live my life and by what thoughts I want to have, like I want to have thoughts that feel good and I don't want to have thoughts that don't feel good, and really understanding that and working on literally rewriting the story of my life, that's been the most life-altering thing. And that's the thing I'm most passionate about teaching.
Wow. Fascinating. So can you walk us through an example? Maybe there's an example in either Hold That Thought or Inner Voices of a concrete example of a belief maybe that you had or that someone that you were working with had, and that process of turning it around. Like,
so my favorite way of doing this is actually to do this in conversation so people can see it in action and how it goes. So would you be willing to volunteer?
That's something I feel we like do. We did something like this when we spoke last.
It wouldn't surprise me, because that's how people learn. It's just like the funnest way to do things. Because I could say, I said this to myself, and then I said this to myself, but to like actually live it, you can bring up a situation in your life that's like super non-charged. Like you went to the store and the guy gave you the wrong change. Like it could be something really simple like that. Or it could be a mom thing, because this is what you're passionate about.
Okay. So what do you want? You want
a situation that was upsetting for you.
I mean, when my kids were totally fine and I stepped into the kitchen to like bake something, and the next thing I know, like one had stabbed the other one with a pencil and were calling me back. I mean, it wasn't terrible, but it was kind of upsetting on a few levels.
Okay, great. So that's like a perfect example. We can all relate to that, especially those of us, you know, who've had kids who've ever held sharp objects or threatened things with sharp objects. My son was like really into that when he was little. It's like, he'd like to pick up a knife and like threaten us. Like that made him feel really strong, but thank God he never actually did anything with it. So you're in the kitchen and you're about to bake something. And then there's the moment between that and when you're upset. So what I want you to do is stretch that out. This is a tool that I introduce in my book, Inner Voices, called the slow poke. We're going to slow down time, and then we're going to poke right at there and find what is it that you're believing in that moment that's making you feel upset. So if you need to close your eyes, you can do that. Otherwise, if you could just sort of just slow things down.
Okay.
And look at that moment right before you got upset. What were you thinking?
I mean, I was thinking that I'm excited for what's going to come out of the oven. And I was thinking that like, it's so wonderful to be a mom with such wonderful children and to have so many like toys and just, you know, things that they can be occupied.
So now I want you to move forward in time till you get to the point where you identify the thoughts that made you upset.
Okay. So I think there are a few that are coming up, and I have my eyes closed because you guys listening can't probably see. So few of the thoughts that were coming up was one, like, what did I do wrong? Another one was, they were fine a second ago. Why is it now that they started fighting? Another one was, is everybody okay? Especially the child that was screaming because she was hurt. And then another thought was, there must have been something that provoked the other child, because that child does not usually do things like that unprovoked.
Okay, that's enough. That's okay. That's plenty for us to work with, because we're only going to find one thought. So you can open your eyes now. And one of the things that's really important is that you can question a belief. You can't question a question. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Right. So the first three things you stated were questions, which is totally normal and fine. But what we want to do is we want to shift that language to make it into a statement so that we can work with it. Okay. So you said, what did I do wrong? That happens to be, of all the things you said, that happens to be my favorite. I would expect that that would be the most charged statement of everything you said. Is that true?
Yes.
So to me, I like to work with the things that have a lot of charge, because that means they also have a lot of punch.
Okay.
So, how could you turn what did I do wrong into a sentence?
I must have done something wrong.
Perfect.
Because the children are.
You don't even need the because, just I must have done something wrong. Okay.
Okay.
So, or I did something wrong.
Okay.
I'm just going to go with I did something wrong just to make it a little bit more efficient, because I'm going to have to repeat that sentence a few times and just to make it easier for me. Okay. So there you are in the kitchen and you're baking and you hear the noise from the kids. And now I'm going to ask you a question. Okay. So the following process that I'm going to share is called the work of Byron Katie. Byron Katie created a process for inquiry, for questioning our thinking, that I find to be really, really easy to teach. I use lots of tools for inquiry and share a lot more tools for inquiry in my books. But right now, for the sake of simplicity, let's just use Byron Katie's tool. So the first thing we do is we ask the question, is it true? Is it true you did something wrong?
Not necessarily.
Great. So you kind of answered the second question along with the first. The second question is, can you absolutely know that it's true?
No.
So necessarily and absolutely are synonyms here. And how do you react when you believe the thought that you did something wrong?
I'm like, I'm upset at myself. I'm sad. And so I think I act from like an emotional place.
And what do you feel in your body when you're believing that you did something wrong?
I feel my shoulders droop. I feel just this sense of like defeat. My stomach sinks. I feel like I'm dragging. I don't know.
All of that physiology does two things. One is, in my book, Inner Voices, I have a chapter called The Bear Trap. And this to me is the bear trap. You feel wrong, right?
Yes.
Like you feel bad. And so then you might come to the conclusion, see, I must have done something wrong because I even feel wrong.
Hmm.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So you end up using your physiology as evidence for why your belief is true. The thing is that when our physiology does this, when it closes in, as opposed to being open and calm, it closes in and gets tight and emotional. That's an indication that whatever it is we're believing isn't true. So I use people's physiology as a way of testing what's true or false for them. So today I was dealing with a client who's in the middle of dating process, and they're trying to figure out if the person they're dating is a good match for them or not. And I don't think it's my job to assess that. I mean, unless the person was like dangerous or something, but that's not the situation, right?
Yeah.
It's not my job to assess it. So I simply asked questions and I paid attention to this client's physiology. And every time the client talked about marrying their partner, their physiology went very calm and very open. And every time they talked about leaving their partner, the physiology got tight and closed. So right away, that tells me, wow, this person's body knows more than they haven't caught up with their body yet.
Hmm.
It's like their body's telling them what's true and they're not there yet.
Mm-hmm.
So for you, your body is telling us that this idea that you did something wrong must be false. Not because I can intellectually talk you out of it, but because your body's telling me it's false. Right. And the other thing that happens when you're in that place and you're believing you did something wrong, what is your connection to God like in that moment?
Non-existent.
Non-existent, right? So
I'm not even thinking. Yeah, there's no awareness of
right. So we say in the Shema prayer, we say Hashem Elokechem Emet, the Lord your God is truth. God lives in the place of truth, and God's not there, so to speak, right? Obviously, God's sure. everywhere, but in that moment, it feels like God's not there. And we also have a mitzvah to live with joy, and you're not in the place of joy. So you're really out of sync with that mitzvah. The reason we have that mitzvah is only in the place of joy are we able to connect to God, and are we able to be in what's true? Okay. So truth and joy and God all come together.
That's interesting, especially now in Adar. You know, when we're recording this, it's like, this is the month where we're commanded to be joyous to a different level than usual even. So,
and this is the month when the Jewish people really exhibited the highest level of faith, the highest level of emunah, by choosing to be in relationship with God, even in the darkest of places.
Right.
But they didn't allow their circumstances to define their emotional state and their relationship with God. They decided, no, we're going to connect to God no matter what, even though life looks pretty bleak.
Right. Right. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So,
we've asked the first three questions.
Okay.
Right. You understand your physiology and how you reacted. We asked the first three questions. Is it true? Can you absolutely know that it's true? And how do you react? And you have this closure reaction. And then we can ask the question. You close your eyes, take a deep breath, put yourself back in that kitchen, and imagine the thought that you did something wrong, leaving you and going out the door. And there you are without the thought that you did something wrong. How are you without it?
I'm seeing myself just kind of standing very grounded, like with 2 feet on the ground and shoulders back and like a ballerina, like torso sucked in and like not cocky, not ego-driven, but just, I guess, confident and okay with the fact that the kids are fighting and kind of understanding that there's always like a time and a place for this. And I get to just approach it in the best way that I can.
And also, just like we said, how, you know, kids are really bad at art and cooking and writing. They're also really bad at interpersonal relationships, but they're getting better every day. Right. Right. We hope that by the time they're 20, they're no longer stabbing us with pencils. That's kind of the goal. I've been noticing, my son is 17, and I've been noticing every week more and more, he's stepping outside of himself and expressing gratitude and seeing other people's needs and trying to be more sensitive and more attentive. And I'm like, oh, look at that. That's just happening all by itself, right? It's just like,
oh my gosh.
No matter how many times I tried to drill that into him when he was 8, it's like, it takes its time. It's like, that's its thing.
But it's all that lead up, you know? I mean, he's lucky. You've been his mom for 17 years, you know? Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So now we've got these four questions. You understand, first of all, you question the truthfulness of the belief, which already takes you a step away from it. Even writing the belief on paper, you can say, oh, that's that, and I'm here. Sure. Sometimes we get confused and we think it's who we are. We're so attached to our beliefs, but it's not, you know, it's not like a pair of shoes that you've accumulated or a car that you've accumulated. It's just a thought and it doesn't belong to you. And here it is on paper. And now I'm going to question whether it's true, which creates a distance. I'm going to see, oh, what do you do to me? What do you not do to me? I'm really going to give it its time. And embedded in that belief are lessons. That belief came to you because it has a whole bunch of lessons to teach you. And it's there to reveal to you your values so that you can live them with more integrity. Okay. So the way you understand that is by saying the opposite of the belief. So what's the opposite of you did something wrong?
Did something right.
Can you give me 3 examples of how that's true?
Yeah. I mean, I have a beautiful family. Everyone's safe and happy and has food to eat on a regular basis. There are lots of things that I think I've done right in life.
So let's kind of hone in that moment in time. There you are in the kitchen. How is it true that you did something right?
The kids are interacting with each other. They know how to get heard when they need to.
Oh, like one needed help and they came to you?
Yeah. Or they screamed. That's also a way of getting attention. I don't know. Help me out.
So something that came up to me, is there something you could have done to prevent kid A from stabbing kid B?
In that moment, I think the only thing that I could have done really is been there with them, like continued to stay there with them and play with them on the ground, you know.
Right. So you could do that all day, every day, correct?
Right. Correct. Yeah.
Right. Would that be good for them?
No.
Why not?
Because it's healthy for them to have a good dose of mom, and they need to learn how to occupy themselves and how not to be 100% dependent on mom being there every minute. They develop, you know, social skills, they develop, I guess, adaptability, and there's so much that they need, that they gain from not having mom with them every second.
So that's the thing you did right. Walking away and leaving them to mm-hmm. navigate their relationship on their own. There's something Jordan Peterson says that's like resonating for me right now. He says it's so important to understand the evil of which you're capable so that you can then harness that and have self-control and navigate life. That there's nothing more dangerous than a person who thinks they're not capable of evil. Those mm-hmm. are the most dangerous people that exist. So for both of the kids, right, the kid who did the stabbing to understand, wow, I can do really bad things. I need to learn how to harness that within myself. Mm-hmm. But he kind of needed the space to do that. And then for the other kid to recognize, wow, my sibling can do some really bad stuff. I have to be really careful to respect this kid's needs and boundaries right. and communication. Otherwise, I might get stabbed again. So for them to understand the evil of which each of them is capable and the other is capable is actually a really healthy thing. Hmm. And they might be nicer in front of you than they are just with each other.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, like when they have undivided attention, you know, the dynamic changes. Oh, I love that. Okay. So now like you've kind of helped me like reframe that situation. So just in the next like minute, walk me through like, what's the implication of that?
Yeah. So whenever you find yourself being in any way emotionally agitated, you ask yourself the question, what am I believing that made me feel upset? So if you could do it in the moment, great. If not, like you just did, you thought back about a moment in the past, and now you get to rewire that moment. And you do this entire process, and then you ask yourself, how do I take action on this opposite, right? That's what I call being an action superhero. How do you take action? So for you, it might be making a conscious effort to leave your kids alone more often and making a conscious effort that when they do hurt each other, to say, I'm doing something right. This is a value for me to teach my kids independence. That might be a way that you can take action. But asking yourself, what action steps can I take right now to move more in the direction of my values? So independence and you having independence and teaching your kids resilience, these are your values. So you get to live more in alignment with your values. Being like the super mom is not really a value. Your ego loves it, but it's not actually a value for you.
Right. And also something that's coming up for me with that situation is like having those conversations with the kids about how we treat each other and what we can do in various situations and things like that, which is also a value. So amazing. That is so helpful. Ladies, I feel like this has to be resonating at least with some of you, because I know I'm not the only one that's in this situation. And Chana, you're really masterful at this shift, this reframe and highlighting it and bringing it to life. So thank you so much for sharing that. I know I want to read more about it, and I'm sure some of our listeners do. So where can we access, you know, your works, that your two books, Hold That Thought and Inner Voices? And then also, I know you have a program coming up called Slay Your Dragon. So maybe you can talk for just a minute.
Yeah. So my books are accessible on my website, hanamason.com/books. So you can put that link up for people to access.
Yes.
And the Slay Your Dragons, I think I gave you a link for that also that you can post. Slay Your Dragons is a course where we literally focus on the material you and I just did, but going a lot deeper. And it's an 8-week course. It starts May 1st. And people get to have a 2-hour live session every week, plus every day they have exercises to do. They get paired up with a buddy. They get to practice these tools so that they just become rote. I often have therapists and coaches or social workers take my courses and use those tools immediately in their practice and notice a difference in their own therapeutic practice. And also people who just want to learn this stuff for themselves.
Amazing. So we will put those links in the chat, both for Chana Mason's books and for Slay Your Dragons. If you want to sign up, the link is bit.ly/Chana Mason. And we'll put that in the show notes as well. Chana, thank you so much for joining us. Ladies, thank you for tuning in. So wonderful to be here with you again. And we'll see you next time. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to the Two Mom Life podcast. If you liked what you heard today, please remember to rate us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. If you would like to learn more about me and my work helping moms feel filled up and in balance, or helping moms integrate family adventures, big and small, into mom life, or to explore how we can work together, visit my website, loveadventuremom.com, or find me on Facebook and Instagram at the handle loveadventuremom. Till next time, l'chaim, to life.